Welcome to House Einstein Podcast 12. I am Osman Parvez with House Einstein.
And I'm Hamish Crabb, also with House Einstein.
All right, good afternoon. Today, we are talking about a very exciting topic in real estate. We're talking about disclosures. And it's very relevant for us at the moment because we have a deal in play. I won't reveal the address or the listing agent's name. We represent the buyers. And it's the second deal, actually, that's happening right now that the seller has decided to either not provide a disclosure at all or has sent over a signed blank disclosure with no information filled out at all. And both of these circumstances are the seller has owned the house for decades, plural. In one case, it was a rental. In another, it was mostly owned by them and then a rental for a few years. Mostly they lived in it and then it was a rental for a few years. But both of these circumstances were unusual in that we got blank disclosures. And I say unusual, it's not entirely uncommon, particularly with rental properties, that the seller says, hey, I've never lived in the house or I haven't lived in the house in years and therefore I can't disclose anything, which is complete nonsense. Right. If you're the landlord, you know when things break. You know when you service the HVAC. You know the age of the roof. It's not a surprise. You may not know that there's a leak under the sink in the same way you might know if you live in the house personally. But absolutely, you know about its maintenance and condition and the repairs that have been undertaken during its rental history because your tenant complained about it and you sent over a plumber. So I'm not entirely sure why we're seeing this in the market. I don't know who is advising these listing agents to tell their clients to not disclose. So years and years ago, I remember the first, well, very distinctly remember Oliver Frascona, who was an attorney who advised the real estate industry here in Boulder. That Hamish, your typing is very loud.
Okay. It's very distracting. I don't know how to fix that.
Yeah. It's very distracting. That advised, it could just be in my ears. But so this attorney used to teach classes for real estate agents here in Colorado. He's very well known. Even today, his firm still has his name on it, Frascona Joyner Goodman. And he told the agents he was teaching about disclosures to advise our clients to disclose what you know. He also said this, if you're on the buy side, the SPD or seller's property disclosure here in Colorado is a document that the seller lies about the condition of the home on. Like, you really should take it with a grain of salt. But there's actually much more to the story when it comes to seller's property disclosures. I guess I should stop for a moment and mention that we're not attorneys at House Einstein. And even though we advise our clients on navigating Colorado real estate and the laws and the contracts that govern Colorado real estate, we don't do that for other states. And if you are not a client that's actively engaged with us, this is not to be considered as advice in your transaction. At best, this is probably, it would be good to consider this podcast as humor. And maybe we'll try to make it a little more funny for you just to emphasize the point. But it's not legal advice is what I'm trying to say. If you are trying to get advice on your real estate transaction, whether it's here in Colorado or elsewhere, talk to your agent and get advice from your service provider, not from the House Einstein podcast. And I think that disclaimer should satisfy the attorneys that advise us that we've done our job advising you as a listener or a watcher of this on YouTube that this is not legal advice to you. And in other words, don't sue us for what we're about to say and talk to your own agent. Okay. With all of that said, boy, disclosures have such a big impact on the real estate transaction process. The biggest impact is when the buyer receives the disclosure and how they react to it. This is your inflection point as a seller in the transaction. And Oliver told us to disclose what you know. Tell your clients, dear agents, to disclose what they actually know about the condition of the property. Don't hide it. It may come back to bite you. He also said, don't disclose what you don't really know to be true. So, for example, if you think the furnace might be on its last legs, it doesn't necessarily mean you're right that the furnace is on its last legs. Are you an HVAC technician? What has led you to believe this? But if you had a furnace technician come and visit you, and they told you that the furnace is at the end of its life, should be replaced, they wrote it on the invoice, and you said, this person's crazy, I'm not putting that on my seller's property disclosure, you potentially could find yourself in some hot water and be liable for failure to disclose. And we were just talking to a client about this, receiving this blank seller's property disclosure. She happens to be an attorney. And she said, you know, Osman, this is nuts. I can't believe it's blank and they signed it. And I said, I know, I don't really know what to tell you. Otherwise, it raises a yellow flag to dig deeper. She's like, it sort of raises a red flag. I'm like, well, except it's not that uncommon. It shouldn't be. It's ridiculous. And yet it's not that uncommon, particularly with rental properties. And she said, failure to disclose is fraud. Period. And I'm not an attorney, but Dr. Google seems to agree with that. When you go down that rabbit hole and ask yourself, is failure to disclose fraud? The answer is, yeah, probably. And it really, you don't have to get to a lawsuit. There doesn't have to be litigation in 5 years over your failure to disclose for it to not influence the transaction today, or for it to influence the transaction today. So when you get a blank seller's property disclosure, it immediately casts the seller as suspect. Why are they not disclosing anything? They've owned this house for decades. They're showing nothing of material value in the disclosures. It creates distrust in the transaction and distrust of the counterparty, which now makes every aspect of the deal more difficult going forward. Trust is the secret ingredient in real estate transactions. And what we do at House Einstein is we advise our clients to pre-inspect the property before we list. I will personally pay for the inspection at closing. So we will credit you the cost of inspections as a seller. If you're listing a home with us, I'll gladly write a check, because it creates a dramatic increase in trust when you have pre-inspected it and you provide that inspection report to the buyer and you provide a cover letter of all the things you did to correct the home prior to listing it, all the issues you chose to correct. And maybe you chose not to correct things. That's fine too, but you've disclosed it. And so the secondary round of negotiation that sometimes occurs over newly discovered issues where you're under intense pressure to get the deal done, and you're now dealing with the gold-plated contractor, and we know some of those contractors in Boulder whose estimates are 2 times the normal price, now you're getting that from the potential buyer that has it under contract. You've changed the status, right? So it looks like if you break up with this buyer, everyone's going to want to know why. And they never believe you when you say the buyer's crazy. They just immediately conclude something's wrong with the house. Mm-hmm. And so all of those things could have been avoided if you, and the gamesmanship. So some buyers are well known to use the inspection process to claw back on visible and obvious defects with the property, right? They know that they have now have leverage in the negotiation, and they ask ridiculous numbers on what are relatively normal issues. Like, instead of it being a $2,000 hot water heater, it's a $5,000 credit they're asking for on the hot water heater or the walk. And they'll get their earnest money back. They have nothing to lose other than their inspection costs and their agent's time. And you as a seller are dealing with the risk of tainting your listing. So all of that gets avoided by having the inspection before you go live, contacting the contractor of your choice. It could be a handyman, to address what are actual material issues with the property, and then providing a cover letter that we merge with the PDF. So it's the first page. Here are all the things the seller did. And the seller ends up looking like a rock star, and trust and transparency increases in the transaction. And it usually is a very good thing.
And that's the thing too, right? Is when it comes inspection time and you haven't pre-inspected or addressed certain things that have now come up on inspection, the buyer could very well ask that it's only mitigated by, you know, the gold-plated company and the most expensive thing for the seller as well, where it could be just a very simple fix that a handyman could do.
Right. It could be a plumber replaces a heating element in the hot water heater instead of replacing the whole hot water heater. It could be that the furnace is cleaned and the igniter is replaced or whatever issues it needed. It could also have a notation from the HVAC technician, furnace is in good working order, should be fine for at least 5 years, written on the invoice, right? Mm-hmm. And now you have an HVAC technician who has a higher level of credibility than the home inspector when it comes to large appliances in the house or roof, same issue. And that's what the inspector will do. If they see something that is suspect, they will punt on advising you and say, okay, go contact an HVAC technician, go contact a roofer. We think
see a structural engineer.
Yeah. If they see a hairline crack, see a structural engineer. And they do that because they're in CYA mode. But you now have time to chase down those rabbit holes. The idea that the buyer will not conduct an inspection and may not see these issues is unlikely. Even in a bidding war, the vast majority of buyers don't waive inspection entirely. They will conduct at least a health and safety level inspection, and they'll look for major issues with the house. Sometimes they look for a lot more than major issues. Okay, let's talk about the flip side of that. So the flip side of this is that if a buyer has written, so they're when they're in the honeymoon period of the contract, they're in love with the property, they write the offer, they get it accepted, there's an excitement level, right? There's an emotional energy to the transaction. They're really, they're looking for all the right things. And then they hire an inspector who tells them all the things that are wrong. But they're already engaged at this point, right? They have committed $500 to $1,000 in inspection costs. So now they've got skin in the game. And if you give them an inspection report before they've made the emotional decision to purchase the property, it's sort of like getting a health report card on somebody you're just going out on a first date with, right? Like you're getting a lot of detail on the conditions of the home that potentially can dampen their enthusiasm, and they have no skin in the game. So handling that seller's property disclosure and the cover letters, the additional materials we provide in the process to the buyer, how that's handled is really important. Like, you really want to make sure the buyer has some engagement before you give them a whole bunch of due diligence documentation that is sort of energy sapping to go through that documentation, unless you've prepared it in such a way as it looks really good, right? Like, I mean, we talk about cars a lot, Hamish. It's sort of like getting, before you've even seen the car, somebody handing you a giant stack of maintenance
service receipts. Yeah.
Right. You're like, okay, well, your first question is, what's wrong with this house? Why does it have so many service receipts?
Right. Yeah. It's similar to, you know, when we're talking negotiation, I think we brought this up as well about, like, you need to kind of counter on something. Otherwise the buyer gets it in their head that this was too easy. Right. And they'll get light feet on that. Right.
Right.
It's the same thing with kind of disclosing.
Yeah. I mean, it's, for sure. Most counterparties in a real estate transaction need to feel or express some imperfection in the deal. Otherwise, the matrix crashes. So, and there's a saying in the business where if it's kind of a painful deal for both sides, it's probably a good deal. Like, if the price is higher than the buyer wanted to pay, but it's lower than the seller wanted to accept, it's probably right, because you've argued over, you've kind of arm wrestled, or you've had a tug of war. That little tug of war from a negotiation perspective tends to keep a deal together. When people feel a little bit of negativity, if it's all positive, right? You offered $1 million for the house. They agreed to $1 million. They just signed your contract. They didn't even counter on a single date. Usually the deal falls apart because it's too good. The matrix crack. Like, I got the, what was that? It's the, like, Willy Wonka line.
Oh, kids who always get what they want. What, how does it go?
What happened? Do you know what happened to the boy who got everything he always wanted?
And he lived happily ever after.
Charlie Bucket's like, what? His eyes go wide. And, you know, Willy Wonka's like, he lived happily ever after. But that's not true in real estate land. The deal crashes. The matrix falls apart.
You need some teamwork, some trauma bonding between the buyer and seller. you know,
some trauma bonding. Yes, absolutely. So in Colorado, and I believe this is true in many states, but it's definitely true in Colorado, the real estate agent representing the seller, the listing agent, is not allowed to fill in the seller's property disclosure. This is supposed to be the seller's disclosure to the buyer based on their actual knowledge of the condition of the home. And it varies by state. In Colorado, we have, I think, a 10-page disclosure. And at the very top of it, and I'm going to share screen. I don't know how well this will work in the recording, but we're going to go ahead and do it.
We will learn together.
We will learn together. All right. I think
be as descriptive as possible for just the audio listeners out there too.
Okay. All right. So this is the seller's property disclosure from the Division of Real Estate that's regulated by the Colorado Real Estate Commission, the Division of Regulatory Agencies. Sorry, the Department of Regulatory Agencies, Division of Real Estate, also known as the Colorado Real Estate Commission. This is the most recent SPD, which is from 2019, was the last time they updated this. And at the very top, it says, first, it's been approved, right? Because everything licensed real estate agents in Colorado are on forms that have been pre-approved by the Real Estate Commission. Mm-hmm. And at the very top, it says seller's property disclosure. This happens to be the residential version. There's a land version. There's a commercial version. And it says, seller states that the information contained in the SPD is correct to the seller's, and this is in all caps, current actual knowledge as of this date. Any changes must be disclosed by seller to buyer promptly after discovery. Seller's failure to disclose a known adverse material fact affecting the property or occupant may result in legal liability. If the sales contract requires seller to complete this SPD, this form must be fully completed to seller's current actual knowledge as of the date of the contract. If seller has knowledge of an adverse material fact affecting the property or occupants, it must be disclosed whether there is a specific item on this SPD or not. If the property is part of a common interest community, this SPD is limited to the property or unit itself, except as stated in section O. Broker may deliver a copy of this SPD to prospective buyers.
Okay. So go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What's your question? For me, the only kind of, and I say kind of in big, bold italic, is current actual knowledge, right? Because it couldn't technically the seller have forgotten something and then it wouldn't be current. How do you define current, right?
I don't know so this is maybe a legal question. If the seller forgets that the house was full of asbestos and 30 years before they had a test done on the popcorn ceiling and the test said the popcorn ceiling has asbestos and it's the bad kind, and then they forgot, well, I would say they were given that knowledge.
They should have the documentation, yeah.
I mean, if you forget that there's a speed limit and you drive 100 miles an hour down the highway, I don't think that absolves you from your legal responsibility to drive within the speed limit. I think that forgetting is not an out.
No.
And the real question is, what if in the contract the listing agent has countered on the SPD to say there is no SPD, not applicable? My understanding is that whether it's on the SPD or not, the seller is required to disclose known material defects, adverse material defects in the property. And it's not just the seller, it's also the listing agent. And it's also the buyer's agent, both agents in the transaction. So if you or I, Hamish, we're licensed agents, if we walk into a house and we see a giant crack in the foundation,
We got to say something.
You can't pretend it's not there. You got to say, look at that giant crack, right? Even if the buyer's staring at it, you can't pretend like you didn't see it. So, and you also don't have to, in fact, you're not supposed to wait for the buyer to say, hey, Osmond and Hamish, did you notice anything wrong with the house? Your duty to disclose is actually proactive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not reactive to the question.
Yeah, you're not dependent on input, right? You have to provide it yourself.
You have to be upfront about it. The real question is, what's actual knowledge? And thinking the roof is old because it's 15 years old doesn't necessarily mean the roof is at the end of its life. And if you haven't been up there and you're not a roofer, I think you've got probably some ground to stand on that you didn't know. Just because of the age of the roof doesn't mean the roof is shot. And you might think the roof might be shot, but do you actually know? And so that's the question. You know, in the interest of protecting yourself from liability, it's probably better to over-disclose. And in most cases, that's what we tell our clients. With that said, we typically represent very, very intelligent people. And they often have deal experience outside of real estate. And in the world outside of residential real estate, disclosures tend to be more thorough. And really thorough disclosures can do the opposite as well. It can scare a buyer. So you have to consider the presentation and the depth of the information and the story you're telling. Because this document has a tiny little box for comments. And you may want to create a secondary document that we attach to this SPD and that explains very simply in plain English what you know and what you did to address it. So if there was a structural crack and the structural engineer or repair company said epoxy is all you need, and you epoxied it and it's been 10 years and there have been no further movement, no other issues, write that in. Was advised to seal with epoxy, had this done professionally, there have been no further movements since that time 10 years ago, and item A1 here, which is structural, has been covered. But you don't necessarily need to write your whole life story into this thing because you might scare them if you do that.
Yeah, you also wonder, right, because it's maybe you can answer this one. What's the difference or where does the line get drawn from SPD to due diligence documents? You know, we had that huge packet of things that we addressed in the pre-inspection report. And maybe it would have made sense to bring that out around the due diligence doc period, or is that even, you know, the correct line of thinking there?
Well, the due diligence document section of the Colorado real estate contract is relatively new. I can't remember what year it was added. I think it's got to be less than 10 years, maybe less than 5 years. And most agents, I think, don't really know what to do with this section still. The first few years of that section was in there, it was very common to get nothing. And more recently, as when we represent buyers, we put in some pretty standard verbiage that we've come up with that makes it clear we're going to ask for a few things. We might ask for utility records from the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. We might ask for pre-inspection reports. We might ask for radon reports, mold reports. If they, you know, pulled a permit for something, we might want to get a copy of the closed permit. If they had building plans drawn up but didn't execute on them, we might want to get those. So all of that could be in the due diligence document section. Is there litigation? The problem is, from a negotiation perspective, if you create a giant list of questions or due diligence documents for the seller to provide in the original contract, well, they may choose another offer because they may think you are... You don't want to appear to be difficult. So we usually use some pretty generic standard verbiage in the due diligence doc section. And then as soon as we're under contract, we talk to our buyer and ask, what do you really care about? Let's make sure we get documents that you really care about. And if they pretend they don't have them or they don't have them, we'll let you know. But we don't usually write it from a competitive perspective. I usually don't write this giant list of documents, but I do follow up with our client about documents that they care about. Some of them, honestly, utility bills are much more relevant to the person in the house than the house itself.
Yeah.
Because some people, you know, run the water. Some people don't close the windows in the winter. Some people want their house at 80 degrees.
Yeah, this is true. I'd say it could be helpful, you know, if you can compare against your own. And I mean, there'd be a lot of scaling and math involved to try and work out your current usage and then either scale it up or down depending on which home you're going to. But I imagine it's nice just for a general ballpark, right?
Right. It is nice. And if you're on the sell side of the deal, prepare for this request.
Mm-hmm.
Download those documents in advance. Find out the age of the roof, the age of the furnace. Pull out any warranties you have. If you had work done remodeling your kitchen, dig out that old folder And ask your agent to digitize it. It'll only take a few minutes with the right apps, and we'll have those documents to give proactively. And you, again, you look like a rock star when you do that. And when you wait to be asked about these things, or worse, provide blank documents with no disclosures, you look like a criminal. You look like you're hiding something. And the buyer may find out. So one of my favorite stories, this is a good one. We'll segue, Hamish. I'm going to stop sharing my screen for a second.
Yeah, good idea.
So this is in Martin Acres. It's a neighborhood in South Boulder. It was a tri-level, I think it was about a decade ago. And I was representing the buyer, and we put this house under contract. It was on one of the little circles, those little half circles off of Moorhead. Mm-hmm. And the seller provided a seller's property disclosure, but didn't disclose anything about water damage. So I think this was after, it had to be after 2013. And as part of our normal due diligence process, I always advise my clients to go talk to the neighbors before your inspection period is expired. And just to get a sense of what's going on in the neighborhood, but you can also ask them what they know about the house. And if you do it the right way, people will like to talk. Now, it's possible that they'll be deceptive and not tell you that there are problems in the neighborhood. But more often than not, you can, if you ask the question the right way, you can learn a lot of things. Like, if you have children, you can ask, are there any kids my kid's age in the neighborhood? Or is there anything going on in the neighborhood I should know about? Does everyone get along? Any issues with parking? You can come up with a list of fun questions. Anyway, we asked, what do you know about the house next door? Was there a lot of flood damage in 2013? And what do you know about the house next door? And they're like, oh, yeah, that house got slammed with floodwater. And we're like, what? And they're like, oh, yeah, the floodwater had already hit the entire lower level of this tri-level. And the owners went out and got sandbags to block off the river of water that was flowing through that first floor. And that more or less stopped the water from entering. And we're like, oh. And the look on our faces were obviously something doesn't match. And the neighbor's like, what's the matter? And we're like, the seller didn't say any of these things to us. It's not on the seller's property disclosure. So I asked the listing agent, what's going on? She's like, really? There was a flood? And she called her seller, and then she called me back. She's like, Osman, you're not going to believe this, but the seller didn't really consider that a flood.
It's got to be all three levels to really be a flood, you know?
I'm like, is a flood like your house is floating down the river? That's a flood? I'm sorry. Looney Tunes water- style. Unbelievable. And today the disclosure document has, you know, the word moisture, right? It's not just looking for, it says moisture or water is what it's asking about. The word flood, I don't even know if it's in here, but they're not, they've changed the language because probably people have different interpretations of what a flood was. But so here's what happened to our deal. My buyers were like, if she's lying about the flood, what else is she lying about? And, you know, they were feeling stretched financially to buy this house. It was their first house as a young married couple. I got the feeling there was some stress in the relationship too. There was stuff going on, and it really caused an erosion of trust, not just on that deal, but with us as their agents. They felt like we should have known better. I don't know what else we could have done. But it killed the deal, and it actually damaged my relationship with the buyer, even though we were trying our best to help them. And our advice to them on due diligence is what uncovered this. It still cost us the deal. I was fine with that. We did our job, but it still sucked to have that whole deal fall apart because the seller failed to disclose.
First floor, not a flood. Oh, I know why. It's because not more than 2/3 of the building had water in it. You know, it's got to be. I'm trying to think about trying to justify it from the seller's perspective.
I mean, it's human nature, right? People will reframe circumstances to not make themselves the bad guy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even when they clearly are the bad guy, humans never want to paint themselves into that box. We never want to cast themselves as the person who lied, cheated, and stole. It's just how it is. I drove down to Broomfield yesterday, and on the drive, I was listening to a podcast where a woman was talking about how she was abducted, and she discovered this as an adult when she couldn't get benefits for she was like a young mom, and she was looking for health, like healthcare benefits and other types of public assistance, because she didn't have a job. And she went to go file for this, and they looked at her birth certificate, and they couldn't find a corresponding record. And they told her her birth certificate was false. And she went back to her, like, she couldn't believe it. She went back to her mom, and her mom said, "Oh, you should have let me handle this." And that was very strange. And it turned out, long story short, that the mom had abducted her as a small child in the late 1970s or early 80s. And from the hospital, had gone in as an imposter nurse and abducted this newborn. And her mom tried to, the mom that abducted her.
The abductee?
Told the abductor, the kidnapper, yeah. Told her that her birth mother had abandoned her. That's how she got her as a baby. The birth mother had just abandoned her, and that she found this baby, and that's how she came to be in this family, which was all a lie, right? But, I mean, I'm sure that I mean, people want to look good, right?
How do you – yeah. What podcast is this, Osman? What are you listening to?
It's some true crime podcast. It was really quite dramatic. I'm like, what a disastrous situation. The kidnapper ended up going to prison, and the young lady did find her birth family, and the DNA evidence confirmed that it was her birth family. Nice. But her birth family had gotten her parents, biological parents, had gotten divorced or broke up.
Oh, I bet.
Right. I mean, how do you get over an abducted child? But she now has a lot more relatives than she used to. And I stopped listening after three quarters of this. I'm like, okay, I got the story, and it's not a happy ending.
No, those true crimes rarely are.
No, they're not. But the point of the moral of the story is people will reframe any circumstance, even when they're objectively a criminal that kidnapped a child, to try to reframe it so they don't look so good, so they don't look so bad. Mm-hmm. And this person's like, "Oh, I just didn't think that
was a flood.
Flood water. I didn't think that was a flood." Like, oh, yeah, no, you're so. My tendency, by the way, as a human, is to believe people. I really want to. I believe in the goodness of human beings. It's how I'm wired, and so I'm constantly surprised when people. Maybe I'm not as surprised as I used to be in my 20s, but I'm still somewhat surprised when people behave badly, and. I'm working on that, to not be so gullible. And when people are, you know, have an excuse for why they're behaving badly, it's to cut through the BS and say, okay, no, you're just behaving badly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe you're not a bad human being. Maybe you got dropped on your head as a child. Maybe you had a rough childhood. I don't know what happened to you, but this behavior is not going to work. And, yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound like meet the parents, but there's like circles of trust. You know, there really are.
Yeah.
And the tightest circles of trust, you know, I know they've got my back, right? The group of friends I was in a men's group with for almost a decade, I know those guys are going to have my back. They're rock solid. We went through thick and thin for a decade together. I feel very confident. Our relationship, Hamish, I know I can trust you with our clients. You do a phenomenal job. You show up on time. You are truthful. You do your best, you admit to your mistakes. All of that leads to greater levels of trust. But people that lie and then reframe, you know, the Spidey radar has gotten
more, yeah.
Yeah, it's gotten more sensitive over the years. And honestly, somebody that will give you a blank seller's property disclosure raises all sorts of red and yellow flags and creates distrust. And our clients yesterday went from excitement about writing an offer to completely deflated this morning when I spoke to them, and feeling like, you know, I don't think we're that excited anymore about this house because we don't know. Was it a meth house? We don't know. And the seller's acting cagey, and we just trust our instinct. And there is, I mean, this is sort of philosophical maybe. There is this idea of a whole body yes. There is this idea of gut instinct, gut intelligence in other parts of your body. And I'm now almost 50 years old. I will say that in my life, I've learned that when I ignore that spidey instinct, when something doesn't feel right, my subconscious is signaling. It's screaming, something's wrong. And I just because I want to believe doesn't make it true. right? And so I have to separate that. And when I feel like my gut is saying no, I need to pause and check in on what's going on. Or if my gut's saying yes and my brain's saying no, same issue. We got to get
anytime there's conflict, right?
Got to get the heart and the head on the same page. Got to get your gut to line up with your due diligence and, you know, intellect. And if they line up, it's usually a really good thing. But when they don't line up, it's a signal to pause and check in. And that's what our clients are doing. And I agreed with them.
Mm-hmm.
We should pause.
Yeah. So we're on the wait right now.
I mean, I emailed the listing agent and said, why is the seller's property disclosure blank? I don't think it's the right time to remind this agent of their proactive duty to disclose. They live in the neighborhood. Like, it's the neighbor is the listing agent. So it doesn't help to be like, here's your proactive duty to disclose. We're not under contract. And so...
Go for it.
I mean, I personally have found that it's usually better to be sweet and to be very warm and fuzzy in the contract negotiation process. But once you're under contract, if you represent the buyer, your job has changed from negotiating them the best possible deal to helping them conduct their due diligence. And that it's their responsibility to do due diligence, but there's so many ways the agent can help. And that means asking tough questions and being a sounding board for your client. And that was the conversation I was having with them today. Is this a good decision? And they've got some unique circumstances, our clients, our buyers. And the answer was maybe not. You may want to rent before you buy and take your time to find the right house. There's always another house.
Which is also something we don't push. So when that makes sense to rent, we're generally very receptive to it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I get some agents are really hand to mouth, and this industry is full of starving agents that do a couple of deals a year. And then there's agents that do 80% of the business in the industry. And then there are agents that are so darn busy, you're lucky if you're going to get them on the phone, right? And these are the agents that are broadcasting, by the way. Well, I'm not all of them, but some of the agents that are at the very tip top of volume, they're so busy. Like, I don't know how you can do like 100 sides. That is what they're called in the industry, 100 plus sides a year. And can you imagine if we were doing three to four times the volume we were doing?
And then we were in the
top 10, top agents in the state. Like, and some of these people don't even acknowledge their team. So I don't know how they're able to do it without incredible systems. And the question, I think the right spot is an agent that's not so large that you actually get personal attention, or they have amazing systems, one or the other. And if you're interviewing those agents, you may want to ask about how they're handling their volume.
And also check out podcast number 4, questions to ask your agents.
Good feedback, Hamish. That's true.
Gotcha.
We do have that podcast. So seller's property disclosures, that's the primary document. As a coincidence, my dad and mom are selling their property in upstate New York at the current time. And even though I'm not a licensed agent in the state of New York, they're sending me all the documents to look over in their transaction. And one of those documents today was the New York State from the Division of Licensing Services. It's called the Property Condition Disclosure Statement. So this is effectively the same thing as a seller's property disclosure, but has some unique differences. So here in Colorado, almost across the state, the oil, the mineral rights, as they're called, the subsurface rights have been severed and sold elsewhere. Somebody else owns the value of the resources beneath your house. But in New York State, that's not necessarily the case. Typically, the mineral rights are part of the real estate on the surface. And so the SPD or in this case, the PCD, the property condition disclosure, has a whole bunch of things in here about gas wells and mineral rights and whether or not they're included and agricultural activity is a little unusual. It's asking about lead plumbing. I've never seen lead plumbing, as a question before. So there's lots of things in here that are very interesting to look through. Have there ever been releases of motor fuel, motor oil, home heating oil, lubricating oil? methane gas, petroleum products anywhere on the property.
That's quite comprehensive.
Or from the property onto any other property, right? Because there's liability if that's the case. Mm. There's a lot of detail in here that is not on our Colorado disclosure.
And it's less pages.
And somehow it's less pages. The Colorado version is sort of the most interesting thing is that it asks you, like Section A is about the improvements on the building itself, the actual structures. And it says, if you know of any of the following problems ever existing, and it's in all caps, and you basically have a yes box, there's no box, it's yes or nothing and then comments. And it's structural, it's moisture, it's insect damage, it's hail, wind, fire, cracks, heaving, exterior walls or windows, EFIS, exterior artificial stucco, it's called EFIS. Exterior insulation finishing system is actually what I think EFIS stands for. They have it as exterior artificial stucco. Issues about the roofs, issues about the appliances, including things like the refrigerator. Right, they want to know if you've ever had a problem with the fridge, if you've ever had a problem with your TV antenna. Like, yeah, the reception was bad in the 70s when we had one. Like, they're really asking a lot of questions on our SPD.
And we won't know for New York, but is the seller's property disclosure broken out by land, residential, commercial on IRS? Maybe that's yes. Why.
In DORA, on the website where you can download the standard forms, in Colorado, there is a break. There is a document specific for land. There is a document specific for commercial.
Okay. Yeah, there's the possibility it covers some of the other things or is less comprehensive, right, in the different forms.
Well, the commercial one's definitely more comprehensive because for a development, there are also environmental assessments that are usually undertaken. And there needs to be time to conduct those assessments. And those can be expensive. Mm-hmm. They're called type 1 and type 2 environmental assessments. And this is why, you know, your contract could be 3 months or 6 months to closing or a year to closing, depending on the size of the property, the complexity of the deal. If you really want an eye-opener, look at the commercial disclosures and the commercial contract itself. There's more to it than the residential contract.
And these sheets are public.
DORA website. Oh, yeah. And in fact, our request for due diligence documents comes from the commercial contract to buy because they have standard verbiage in there. And so I originally adapted that verbiage to the residential contract because the way I looked at it was DORA, the commission, already approved the commercial language. So I can't, you know, I don't want to play attorney. Let's just use their language. It was a little scary though, so I've dialed it back a little bit, so it doesn't look so crazy.
We had a very formal request for a little while, and it was maybe a little bit too much. Some of the verbiage.
Yeah, well, if it's in a bidding war, right? And that's this is a conversation that we have with our buyers, like how aggressive do you want to be here in the contract? Because you could come across as a difficult buyer. And meanwhile, you're just trying to be a thorough buyer and you can add thoroughness into the contract as soon as you can at least start asking thorough questions. As soon as you're under contract, you can ask for this list of documents. And if they don't give you what you actually want, or they don't actually respond to it, you could just terminate. You're not getting what you need. Mm-hmm. The real estate commission in Colorado is strongly protective of buyers. And the inspection period is, you know, it's at your sole subjective discretion. And if you just can't get information that you need on the condition of the property, that sounds like a valid reason to terminate to me. You check the termination box. Don't say anything else because you don't really need to have some massive argument over why you're terminating with the seller and get your earnest money back. And unfortunately, that sucks for the seller. But that's, you know, the reality of the deal is sellers should disclose what they actually know and should do so as thoroughly as possible.
Yeah.
100%, right? Like,
especially if, you know, if you're not disclosing something and then it comes up on the inspection, you just, I mean, legal things aside, you look ridiculous now, you know, like you're completely untrustworthy at this point.
Especially if it's something that was very easy.
Yeah, for the inspector visible to and find. Obvious.
I mean, look, sometimes it's the situation is they don't know. Like if you ask my mom the condition of the home that my parents are selling, she's not going to know. She doesn't know.
Yeah.
And she's probably not going to remember if she did know. Like, she's getting to an age where, you know, maybe her memory is not as sharp as it used to be, but certainly that was never her area of care, was the house. That was all my dad. Mm-hmm. So it's fair to say, I don't really know. That was always my husband. So if my dad wasn't around to answer these questions, it would be make sense that that seller's property disclosure would be mostly blank. So yeah, that's disclosures for you. And the most interesting part is actually the agent's duties to disclose. So this is where it gets messy in the negotiation. So let's say the buyer finds new issues with the house and says, either you address these issues to our satisfaction, maybe it's a credit. So let's say the roof is bad and it wasn't disclosed. And now we've sent them the inspection report that says the roof is bad. It's got leaks. It's got mold in the attic. It's bad. It needs to be fixed. And the seller says, I'm not fixing anything. Go take a hike. Okay. So the buyer terminates or walks away on the inspection objection because it was never reached a resolution. The seller is required to update the seller's property disclosure. The listing agent is also required to disclose that the roof is bad. Like, you can't hide. So yeah. We've often wondered, you know, when we've terminated deals for our buyers because of what we found on inspection and the seller's lack of response, later the seller goes on to sell it somebody else. We often have wondered, did the seller disclose it? And our clients have said they're very tempted to send the information to the new owner.
Yeah.
By the way, the reason we terminated was X, Y, or Z. I hope that the listing agent and seller told you. It's quite the poison pill. Mm-hmm. And I've told them, look, you can do that. I don't really want to get involved if you do that, because first, it's vindictive, and maybe there's justice in it too, right? Like, this person really should. Maybe you're doing a good thing. I don't know, but I don't really want to stir this pot personally, because we do deals with the same agents over and over again, and it's not going to be beneficial, and you're not getting the house anyway, mm-hmm. right?
It's a little bit like vigilantism, like, you know.
A little.
Yeah.
But maybe they should. I usually say, like, I'm not getting involved. Well, if you want to do that, you're welcome to do so. But, I don't want to be the one conveying that information.
I won't type to look up the exact verbiage, but there was an email you sent a while ago that was something along the lines of, as I'm sure we both know, you have this, you know, responsibility to disclose defects that have now come up.
You know, what's your plan for
like,
that?
Yeah, exactly. Like, we're out. Just also, as I go, you know, this should be disclosed at this point.
The thing is, we will never know whether they actually disclosed after the fact or not, mm-hmm. newly discovered issues. But we certainly, manila envelope could mail it to the actual person who closed. It is kind of bitter pill. It's kind of vindictive. But at the same time, the person who lied about the house didn't disclose. Failure to disclose is omission, is fraud. I feel like should be punished for that, should be liable for that.
Mm-hmm.
And there should be punitive damages too, not just the actual liability, but the rest of the world should see this. The rest of the real estate community should see what happens to agents that don't disclose.
It sounds like a door of responsibility, right? Where it's, you know, there's a system, you know, if you bail out of contract on an inspection item or something that will need to be disclosed, perhaps there's a follow-up from the commission, you know, to check in on the next sale or something. Instead of leaving it to the agents to govern how they see fit, where it can get kind of vigilante and vindictive and, you know, salty.
I mean, I tell agents on our team, don't mess with the division.
Mm-hmm.
The division of real estate holds you to a higher standard than the general public.
Oh, yeah.
And your income is completely dependent on your license. And they can pull your license. They can charge you tens of thousands of dollars in fines. It's not necessarily like the legal standard is a whole nother question to what DORA, what the Division of Real Estate expects out of real estate agents. You're a mm-hmm. licensee. It's a privilege. It's not a right. And they can pull it and they can make your life miserable. And, you know, I'm grateful because, frankly, there's some people in this industry that should not be practicing real estate. And I got my first division audit of my continuing education. And I was ready.
This year,
it was
too.
I was a little annoyed. I got to admit, I was just a little annoyed. I'm like, I am so busy. I don't have time. But then I was like, you know what? I already prepped this. They're all sitting in the same folder. I have a cover sheet with an Excel doc that tells me every credit. I added it up in December to make sure I was good. Like a month before almost a month before the end of the year, like the end of November, I was checking. So I knew I was good. And so I sent it in, and within a week, they replied that you passed the audit. And I'm now grateful, right? I'm glad they randomly audited me. Please randomly audit a lot more agents. I'm totally on board with that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, one of those things where you prepped for it and it was easy to comply because you made sure you were good and on top of things, right?
But it's harder to audit ethics.
Mm-hmm.
But realtors are required to adhere to the National Association's Code of Ethics. And in many cases, there are multiple layers of regulation. There's not an ethical list of rules for licensees, but realtors are held to a higher ethical standard. So if the person is a realtor, 100%, you should file a complaint, not just with DORA or the regulatory body, but also with the National Association. And my understanding, what I've been told, the fear of God has been put into real estate agents that are also realtors, that they will investigate you mm-hmm. and they will make your life miserable. If nothing else, you're going to make your life miserable to prove that you were not unethical. So behave with ethics, behave with integrity, and adhere to the contracts and no contract law in your state.
And disclose.
And advise your clients to disclose what they actually know and not hide things. And on the buy side, if you get one of these blank SPDs, you shouldn't gloss over it. You should ask why. And that's exactly what we've done for this particular house. It appears to be a great house that fits our clients' needs. We've now visited it twice. We've spent a couple of hours in the house. It's a solid property, but it has this really weird situation going on with the seller's property disclosure that casts a shadow across the whole deal. And if it was not for that, we probably would have written an offer this morning instead of talking about seller property disclosures on this podcast.
So my question, what answer, considering this is a blank SPD, what answer would be satisfactory? Maybe a state sale? The condition, maybe the seller has no clue, but then this...
An estate sale actually is a little bit more valid, right? Mm. So if I were required to sell my parents' property, I haven't lived in that house since I was 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad has mentioned to me that the sink drain sometimes needs to be cleaned out, right? And he knows exactly what needs to be done if it backs up. I'm like, okay, hopefully he put that on his disclosure. But I remember him mentioning that to me, right? Mm-hmm. And so...
there'd still be something.
Vague memory. There would be something, right? But I can't disclose what I don't actually know. So if I'm selling it, I don't think I'm going to disclose plumbing problems because I don't have any actual knowledge of anything with that house.
Right.
So, I mean, what am I supposed to write? My dad may have said something to me when I was 20 years old, 23 years, 28 years ago.
Well, that turns into the I think, right? And it's right. actual and so knowledge.
I've owned this house for, or I'm responsible for this house for the last 6 months. I'll disclose what I know during my ownership period or my responsibility period, but I don't know anything about this house. I was a very different human being in my teenage years. I wasn't tracking.
Yeah, much less invested in that.
Right. So how do I answer these things? And I would make it clear that I would write a statement, my knowledge of this house is extremely limited due to the fact I would explain, like put it on a cover letter and attach it to the SPD. Like explain it before that you send over a blank one, or it could be, maybe the couple's divorcing that owns this house and the wife is handling everything and the husband's off and whatever. And the wife doesn't know about the house or vice versa. Maybe it's the husband that hasn't been doing any of the maintenance and doesn't know anything. Mm-hmm. It could be a situation like my parents where honestly, my mom would not know anything.
Right.
Like she might, but anything that comes out of her is going to be very filtered because it's never been her responsibility. Yeah. I don't think she would know. It's always been my dad taking care of those things. So, an SPD for my mom would not be very valuable anyway. Mm-hmm. And so if you're dealing with that as an agent, right, and you have a client that is an unreliable witness to the condition of the house, tell the other side.
Just mention it.
don't just send over a blank SPD. Say, look, my seller doesn't really know much about the house. They, unfortunately, it was something that the husband always handled. And so her knowledge of, I've gone through this with her, and her knowledge of it is extremely limited, unfortunately.
Communication is key.
And she's elderly, and she doesn't have the best memory, and that's what's going on. And her husband handled everything with maintenance and repairs. It was never her area of knowledge. And that would be legit with somebody who has memory issues and is elderly. And
yeah, like, that checks out.
My mom's never changed the oil in a car. She's never bought new car tires. Like, she'd never done the things, right? Mm-hmm. She wouldn't know where to start with that stuff.
So there's places where it's valid, but even then, that the reason it should be blank should be disclosed. Just producing a blank SPD is kind of the biggest, you know, the response should be four question marks.
Or just writing the words not applicable into the counter for the SPD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may want to stop and ask yourself, is this really a counterparty? Is this house worth going to contract with a counterparty that I don't trust?
Right.
Right. And so with risk comes a number. There's a relationship between risk and reward and risk and finance. And so when you increase the risk premium, the price should be lower to reflect that.
Right.
The more you know, the less risk there is in the transaction, and therefore the price should be higher. This is not that complicated. It's why when you and I sell a car and we have a pile of maintenance records and the car is well maintained and we could show that after they've test driven it, the car is worth more.
Yeah.
Because you've documented every single oil change in its history with you. You could show how well you've taken care of it. So that takes risk off the table, and therefore the car's worth more.
Even if you're performing your own labor, you know, include a receipt for the parts. You know, just showing how it worked.
So it's I usually do. So I've got a Google Doc. Mm-hmm. I have the date, the maintenance event, the photos of the maintenance event, and the receipts. And I have not done that for the most recent vehicles, but I used to do that religiously with every vehicle event. Then this is why car dealerships are the worst, because their used cars with them are like, oh, we don't know anything about the car.
And we'd rather not either.
And you're the dealer of this car, so you can look in your computer records and tell me, you know, its entire maintenance history. Oh, we can't do that because of privacy. Like, what privacy is happening with changing your oil regularly?
There's not HIPAA for cars.
No. There's no privacy issue. You can neutralize the previous owner's name, although that still is actually trackable.
Mm.
You can find that sort of stuff if you dig deep enough. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Different industry. Just one we happen to share.
Good parallels. Yeah,
well, in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, $1 million house versus, you know, $30,000 car, very different world. But $1 million house, you would expect much higher levels of disclosure, much deeper levels of due diligence documentation, and much higher levels of professionalism in the parties that engage in the transaction. But unfortunately, there are those listing agents or buyer's agents that act like they're on a used car lot. And it's changing rapidly. We're getting higher and higher levels of licensing and standards. But sometimes we deal with people that don't guide their clients very well, don't advise their clients very well.
And our mission is to share that with you. So hopefully one day you'll make a smarter real estate decision.
Well, that is our mission. That is what we do. That's our brand. That's what we do. It is something I think that does distinguish us from a lot of real estate agencies, a lot of agents themselves, is we've dived deep into this in advising people to be smarter about their real estate decision. And that is on the buy and the sell side. And knowing how to properly disclose, the strategy around disclosures, agreeing on it before you hit the go button on the listing, is really an important thing. And with respect to property in associations, there's also additional things you may want to think about disclosing, especially what does the HOA do? Does the HOA have litigation going on? That sort of stuff actually is going to come up in the transaction, and hoping the buyer doesn't see it is wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Likely they will. And so it's better to have discussed this with your agent and have a strategy around handling it then the hope is not a strategy. Don't choose the hope approach.
We've got a plan. Choose us.
Well, not, I mean, we're not the right fit for everybody.
And you may be out of state listening.
Yeah, I mean, we're not. We just said no to clients this past week. And without going into any details, there was enough in their initial communication to us to suggest that we're not a good fit. They're working with multiple agents at the same time. They're not committing to any of them. They're not telling these other agents that they're dating other people. And it risks a procuring cause litigation, a lawsuit after closing over procuring cause, which probably wouldn't impact us, but we would probably get dragged into it because we knew,
mm-hmm.
right? We knew there was another agent involved. And that alone would create a problem for us. That if we got paid on $1 million deal and collected our commission, and this other agent's like, I did all the work and you got paid, and you knew I was involved in the deal and you knew I was actively working on the deal, I think that would be case shut, right? Like,
yeah, it's hard to worm.
Here's my commission check. I'm so sorry. Like, there's nowhere to go with that. Like, fire your agent cleanly and clearly and then choose another agent if you're not happy with your agent. And don't sign the agreement that makes you exclusive until you've really been sure you're comfortable working with these people. Because a lot of agents won't let you out of their exclusive agreement.
Yeah.
Now you got a problem. And so don't sign it unless you're sure you want to work with these people. And ask yourself, why do you not want to work with these people? If you don't want to sign it, what do you need to know to feel comfortable? Like, it isn't that the agent necessarily is bad. Maybe it's just it's too early. So maybe you just limit it to the transaction that you're focused on because you don't really know these people yet. There's ways around to manage that. You know, you don't have to jump in deep with an exclusive agreement. You can dab your toe into the pool and start to wade in and see how it feels before you, you know, commit to it.
Before you get married.
All right. Well, we're at an hour for the podcast. That's sort of what we're targeting, is about an hour. Going forward, we are likely to have guests on the podcast. It's something that we've started to talk about, but I want to build our library of content a little more. So dear listeners, thank you for being part of the experiment of House Einstein podcasts. We deeply appreciate your referrals. We deeply appreciate your feedback. The feedback I've gotten in person has been great. It's tough for us to track how many people are actually listening, but it's been a very engaging process and we're likely to continue doing it into the future. If you are looking for real estate services in Boulder, that's my area of focus, as well as Breckenridge and the foothills. We've got agents in Denver. We have agents that specialize in South Boulder. So basically anywhere from Denver to Fort Collins is our footprint, and then into the resort towns.
Mm.
And we're doing more into the resort markets. So if that's where you're looking to buy or sell, we'd more than happy to talk to you about your real estate situation and see if we can be of value to you. And if you're looking elsewhere, you're certainly welcome to reach out to us, but we likely would just refer you out to unless we have a pre-existing relationship with you, we will likely refer you out to a trusted real estate agent that we personally vet
mm-hmm.
and interview. Yeah. Anything to add?
I think that's it.
Okay. If you're looking for us, you'll find us at houseeinstein.com.
And
we'll see you next time. Oh,
yeah. We may or may not follow up, I think, on the outcome of this, but I'm pretty sure the offer won't be written for this one.
I mean, you're going to work on the draft.
Yeah.
It's probably a good thing for them to review it anyway, just that way they've read through the draft contracts. But I think that my sense is this is a dead deal.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to move forward, mostly because the seller is failing to disclose. I mean, the house is also probably overpriced. And that's, we've gone through the comps pretty deeply at this point. And we're on the same page with it's overpriced, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't offer. But now you're adding in this bad behavior from the seller and no explanation so far from the listing agent, which probably means it's dead in the water.
Yeah.
Yep. You're right.
Pretty likely. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us. Visit us at houseeinstein.com and we'll catch you next time.